Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it, Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, this is the Occult Disney Podcast, where we look for the hidden Mickeys behind the movies, I guess. I wrote something like that onto our new artwork, but I don't remember quite what it was. And I think I wrote it different somewhere else, but yeah, you get the general vibe there. It's cool. Hi, this is Matt Conwages here. As always, joining me is Thomas Gorenz, the Paranoid American. Hi.
That's me. Yep, Thomas from Paranoid America. Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. I was telling you before, I'm freezing, but and yeah, if you are watching us on YouTube, sorry for the totally surreal flashing. It's like a horror movie or something. So weird Zoom updates. Okay, you know what? Maybe if I just do a quick flip. There I am. Today's film, of course, 101 Dalmatians, a film I think was mostly off of my radar. Like, I know I saw it. I think I saw it when I was a kid, like where they just take all the kindergartners to the weekday matinee to keep them out of everyone's hair. I'm pretty sure I saw this movie that way, and I haven't seen it since. And somehow I'd got it in my mind this was very much like a second tier Disney film. But doing the research, the year it came out, it was like the sixth top grossing film. Of course, they did all these remakes. And the one that blew my mind is they re-released it in 1991. And it was like the 11th highest grossing movie that year, something crazy like that, just from the re-release. I'm like, whoa, people like this, I guess, more than I thought.
It definitely wasn't second tier. If anything, it stood for like the new production method that they had, where they were starting to use Xerox instead of, I assume, just everything prior to this was actually hand painting on cells. But this one, I guess, you can see there's a lot more like pencil sketches and a lot more of kind of like rough artwork in some of the shots. And I don't know if that was just a side effect of like the upsampled versions that we get to watch today, or if that was just inherent in the original new process as they were figuring it out.
Yeah, I guess it's, you know, like Sleeping Beauty is such a big production. Like when you're following the Disney through line or whatever, this can't help but feel like a little bit of a step down, I guess. But
in some ways, but at the same time, I can't remember any other Disney movie prior to this one that actually has so many different unique animated elements on the screen at the same time. So they leverage a lot of the technology in that way. So they've got, I don't think I've ever seen more than maybe, you know, I'm just going to throw a random number out there, but definitely not more than like 20 animated elements on the screen at one time in most of the old classic ones. Whereas this one, in a lot of the frames, you've got all sorts of different characters animating in different planes and stuff. So I don't know. For that reason, it was really interesting to me. And it was, again, I don't really mind seeing some of those like sketchier artworks, and they didn't stand out as much because there were so many of them. If it was a classic one, sometimes just like a little bit of the background being out of focus or just one little thing out of line sticks out a lot more. In this case, there was so much of this kind of, you know, penciled sketch background bleeding through in some of the scenes that I just got accustomed to it, and I kind of liked it.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like I said, coming back to this movie, I was like I could appreciate it more. We did Lady and the Tramp a little while back. I'm like, I feel like this is a better version of that kind of vibe.
Yeah, I agree.
So, because that one, I mean, now I'm like, what was the story? Tramp gets them in trouble. They go to the pound. They get out. Was that it? This one has a little more meat to the bones, and fur to the meat to the bones. That, yeah, of course.
I also appreciated some of the darker sort of aspects of it. You know, like they were actually going to kill these puppies. They're talking about hitting them over the head and skinning them. So they didn't kind of like skirt around the issue quite as much in the cartoon or in the remake.
Would you consider yourself more of a dog person or a cat person?
Probably a dog person. Yeah.
Okay.
I've had both. I've got both. So
yeah, growing up we had both, and I guess I spent more time with the dog, but I think I'm more of a cat person. To be perfectly honest, I'm probably like a no pet person. I don't want to have to be thinking about those sorts of things, but.
I have to say though, this, I don't want to sound like an elitist as from the standpoint of dogs, but there's some dogs out there that are just kind of like a dog that's just, you know, I'm a dog, I'm dumb. I just, you know, I eat, I run around and I get sticky. And then there's some dogs that have like a full blown personality and, you know, kind of like adapt and turn into like a little friend. And I don't know where that line is, but I've definitely met both types of those dogs. And the same thing with like cats. Like sometimes you've got a cat that's got like a really strong personality that only you know about, and then nobody else ever sees it because it's just like either sleeping or hiding the entire time. So like on those ends of the extreme, I really love a great dog versus a great cat. But I think I might like a dumb cat more than a dumb dog. Does that help?
Kind of. Yeah. My aunt always had, you know, two cats in the house when I was growing up. And when you'd visit, you'd never see the cats. They would successfully hide the entire time. It was amazing. So
all you get is the smell and nothing else, right?
And the fur. The
smell and the fur. Yeah,
that's right. I will say for the dogs, I think the bigger, the better. You know, it's the small ones that are super yappy and barking at 3 a.m. And the larger the dog is, the more chill. So Dalmatians are in a pretty good territory. I think if you're going to have a dog that's, you know, they seem to be a little sharper, I guess. What did I have? Of course, you know, I had a mutt as George Carlin. We don't know what the hell it is. But, you know, I think it was like miniature collie, golden retriever mix or something. So, yeah. You know, a medium-sized dog. And that seems to be the best one to have around.
Right. Where would you cut the limit off? Like, how many Dalmatians do you think you could realistically handle?
Oh, two. Yeah, they're not having kids. No, you get them neutered or whatever, right?
You old rascal. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't... I guess our dog was mildly dumb because he chased his own tail a lot. So
I think maybe at my height, I think I had 6 golden retrievers mixed with labs. And at the same time, we had like 2 or 3 smaller dogs. That was a decent amount of dogs for one, you know, one household to contain. And those were huge bags of Old Roy, you know, that we would have to go and grab every other day, essentially, and feed these monsters.
Yeah, see, I can barely be bothered to like take out the trash. So, I mean, I do. I'm just, like, you know, barely, you know, I get it done, right?
And just, just to start this off right too, I just had the random idea of if you legitimately had 100 Dalmatians, like a realistic scenario, and let's say you even got the plantation that they were talking about, but how much food are we talking about, and how much, you know, are you cleaning up after these dogs? And I think I did some of the math to figure out the exact amounts, which was a little bit surprising to me.
Well, you become a dog wrangler and you just, you know, invade supermarkets and stuff, you know, once the dogs get a little bit older and have a little bit of a attack power. Because think about that, you know, give it like 1 year, give it 1 year, and you have like an army of dogs to take the food you want from where you need to take it.
Well, and an adult dog is Dalmatian is somewhere between 40 and 70 pounds. So you start doing the math on that, you know, by an order of magnitude, it starts adding up quite a bit. So you either have to have a lot of acreage just to spread out, you know, all the dog poop on top of all the food that you would need.
Or you prepare to ransack the Target with your army of dogs, which sounds fun. If you had, but even 100,
then, you can only do it so many times until they're out of food, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Then hopefully they restock the stores. You didn't close them. I don't know. I'm. Yeah.
They just put up with you for 10 years plus.
You said you had a lot to say about the book, which is The 101 Dalmatians by Dottie Smith and the author. So do you want to go there first?
Well, I wanted to note that the original author, Dottie Smith, there's a little bit of an interesting backstory. So her husband was this guy, Alec Macbeth Beasley. And I guess they both got Hollywood struck. So they end up moving to Beverly Hills or into Malibu. And they both want to be, you know, in films, and they both have like a little bit of a kick from acting. And Alec Macbeth Beasley, her husband, is kind of an interesting character because his dad was one of the Titanic survivors, and he wrote a book called The Loss of the Titanic SS or something like this. And he actually describes like getting on the boat and like how nice it is and going for a little workout all the way up to the point where he gets saved and he's, you know, he actually makes it off alive. And, you know, it was just lacking some of the pizzazz that I was expecting from like a huge survivor of the Titanic. But it was just, you know, oh, I didn't even know that the boat was sinking. You know, I was dancing and I felt a little off balance. So I went and I checked and I asked if everyone was okay, and they said everything was fine. So I went back to my room, and then I came back out again, and the boat was sinking. So I just walked over, and there was an open sort of, you know, safety boat that I was able to get on with my kid, and they lowered us down, and they almost dropped another boat on top of us, but we shouted and they moved it out of the way, and that was pretty much like, you know, and then he gets saved. So it wasn't the same as the Titanic movie. I definitely think the Titanic movie was a little bit more compelling than this guy's recounting of it, but it was interesting nonetheless. And then that guy's mom was also a famous actress. She was in the Jabberwocky. She was in a bunch of Pink Panther movies. She was also in some Hammer horror movies from the 60s and 70s, which is kind of cool. So there's a little bit of a backstory of them already, you know, being familiar with Hollywood. And then the Cruella de Vil in the Dodie Smith's autobiography mentions that it was based on one of her friends. And one of her friends actually noted that she thought that her dogs would make a nice coat. And I don't know if it was, you know, like a said in jest, or it was, you know, after a few mimosas at brunch and it just kind of came out. But ultimately, it was a real quote from one of her real friends that inspired this entire story to begin with.
I'm going to admit my own flight of being really, really stupid. So I only watched the 1996 one like last night. I'd never seen it before. When it came out, I was, you know, 17.
You're talking about the live action one right now, right?
Yeah. I'm talking about the live action one, right? You know, when that came out, I was like 17. So I wasn't in the demographic for that movie. but I never noticed, except they make it so obvious you can't help. It's, oh yeah, DeVille. Oh yeah, okay, Devil. Really? Like, I never picked up on that before for some reason.
Really? So, because in the cartoon, it's way more obvious. Like, when she goes and answers her phone, it's a literal devil's head with like the pointy red nose and the pointy beard and everything. Like, it's an actual devil that her phone is. So, yeah.
I mean, I noticed that. You see, I noticed that. Oh, that means she's kind of evil. But I didn't notice the name thing until they just...
Her name was literally Devil. Yeah.
Because they spell it on her car and stuff in the live action with like a big D. And I was like, oh, yeah. So, I mean, of course, I always thought, yes, I thought of her as a devilish lass. But last night I was like, oh, my God, I didn't actually like make that connection till just now. Again, I don't think it's so on the nose,
you can't even see it because it's right there in front of your face.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Like I said, this is one of the Disneys I'm less familiar with. You know, I haven't actually seen it since I'm a kid, so I haven't put too much thought into it anyway. But yeah. So I would have just seen the name written in print, basically.
Well, the original story is pretty similar to how the cartoon goes anyways. There's like a few little modifications, which I actually think the cartoon did it a little bit better than it would have if they just followed the book directly. So there's not a lot you're missing out if you haven't read the original book. However, what's even more interesting is that there was a sequel written to 101 Dalmatians called The Starlight Barking. And this was not adopted by Disney or anyone else because it goes a little bit off the rails. It is like the exact opposite of what you might expect from the sequel. So all of the Disney sequels that come out for Dalmatians absolutely don't follow the written sequel. And in the written sequel, all of the dogs wake up one morning and every other animal on the planet, you know, assumingly, has entered some kind of like a Sleeping Beauty type deep sleep. Like no one else will wake up. Only the dogs wake up and a handful of cats that are there to help them. So they wake up, they can communicate through ESP with each other. So they no longer have to do the twilight bark. This is called the starlight bark. So it's like an actual, you know, like we're talking dog to dog through just mental waves. They can fly. They can operate technology on command. Also, I presumably through ESP. So like if they come across a mechanical gate or, you know, a toll booth or something, they can just think their way through it and they can communicate with it. They also God dog comes down from the stars called, you know, he comes from Sirius. He's the actual star god of Sirius. And he basically tells everyone, hey, like you can all return back to me up into the sky. But when everyone wakes up, the humans will just never know dogs existed, but you can come and live with me in the stars forever. And by the way, you might want to do this because there's an oncoming nuclear war that's going to wipe out all of humanity. So like, the Sirius dog star gives all of the dogs this last out, and the dogs like kind of think it over, and essentially they decide that they'd rather be with their masters because the chance of meeting a special human, they just can't miss out on this opportunity. And then, you know, the nuclear war never actually comes, or maybe it does, but it doesn't get into that. And I don't think she ever wrote the third version of this.
The post-apocalyptic one.
As I read over this, though, I didn't read the full book, but I skimmed it. I found like a copy online, and then I read a few different summaries of it. And it is as crazy as it sounds, which makes sense on why that particular book didn't get adopted. But oh, how I wish it did. I really think that this one would have been such an interesting story to adopt, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of like how we need that second Forrest Gump movie where things really get off the rails. which I get what happens in that. It's I guess the starlight barking is a little bit more madness, but no, you're explaining like, well, why didn't they make that an animated movie? Somebody should. Could be like a Return to Oz situation where, you know, you use this property, but you don't use any of the Disney specific stuff. The opposite direction, of course, with Return to Oz, but so, someone could rock that out, I think, you know.
And I mean, I was thinking too on the same kind of properties that you can make this like a horror movie quite easily by just taking the exact premise and just have Cruella DeVille actually see it through and win. Although I think that globally, it's more acceptable to skin a person and turn a person into a coat than it ever would be for dogs, at least in the States.
No, I have friends that'll be perfectly happy to watch 101 slasher films, but they don't want to see like a dog die in a movie, you know?
Or even like, you know, you want to see like a dog hurt its leg in a movie, you know, even if you know it's animated. So
so are you a dog fur coat or a cat fur coat person? Which coat would you prefer?
I would probably go for a hypoallergenic dog coat just for practical reasons.
Yeah, that's kind of the MacGuffin of this movie, which, like you said, if Dottie, I forgot I'll say her name already, but you know, if she had gotten this comment from her friend, at least that's some connection with reality, because otherwise it's like, why would you even want to do that in the first place? I mean, you know, like she's got
syphilis. It could also be like that cute aggression, though. Like I could just eat you up kind of thing, you know, or like I want to just pinch your baby's cheeks right off. There was not a lot of context given because, of course, once you give context to a quote like that and then it explains it, it takes away some of the mystique. So it just sounds better that one of her friends actually, you know, inspired this movie by this comment.
And then the voice actor, who I believe was also the live action, you know, rotoscope reference actor. And what's her name? Get that back. Betty Lou Gerson. Yes. Who was in Cinderella, was it? She had done some previous voice work. But yeah, she was apparently modeling sort of after Betty Davis somewhat. And another reference, but yeah, that's why her clothes don't quite fit. Her gray skin pallor is definitely notable in this movie. Like, again, makes her seem kind of, demonic. I should have gotten this earlier, but...
Yeah, I mean, they kind of beat you over the head with it. Like, she literally has a skull for a head. Like, she doesn't even have any sort of muscles or fat on her face. It's just a skull with skin on top of it.
I guess... I guess there's some red in there, but yeah, black, white is sort of the main, you know, sort of vibe there with the hair. You said you saw the newer movie, but it's talking about, oh, they have to explain like why half her head's white and half her head's black. It, again, you know, origin stories we don't need, like Hans Dice or something, but.
I honestly, I prefer the older one, although I don't think you could have pulled that one off in the live action remake without a lot of CGI or some interesting practical effects, which might have been kind of cool. I don't know.
Yeah. You don't want 1996 CGI on it for sure.
No, and there was a couple scenes that that kind of ruined it for that movie too, but they try to minimize it, so it's not too bad. And then I was wondering in both versions, maybe I just don't pay close enough attention, but it doesn't make 100% sense on where DeVille gets all of this money where she can just afford to hire random goons and then just, you know, use all of her resources to stalk puppies to turn into coats.
Well, the live action one at least paints her as sort of an executive who probably has a notable bank account because she
runs like a Tim Burton-esque clothing studio.
Right. Because in the animated one, she just seems to kind of like stumble in like a vagrant almost, you know?
Well, she almost seems like she's got that old world money because she's got like a Rolls Royce and she's already used to wearing fur. And in the book and in the original movie, Cruella de Vil's just a friend of the wife, you know, of the main character. And that kind of tracks with the autobiography of the author. But in the movie, it's the boss, which makes a million times more sense because then you've got like the Devil Wears Prada sort of dynamic going on where, you know, you want to impress the boss. But it didn't make sense in the book, in the movie, the original animation. Like, why are they even friends? They don't seem, it doesn't seem right at all that these two different people would even be in the same sphere. And I think they explain it away in the original that they were roommates or, you know, they had known each other early on, but it still doesn't make any sense why they would still be associating with each other.
Yeah, you are right. It makes more sense in the live action one, but I kind of like the insane relationship that we see in the book and animated movie. I'm like you said, it doesn't make sense, but I just liked watching that for some reason. I don't know. I guess it's because, you know, you tend to have like that bizarro friend here or there, right?
Yeah, I guess so. They spice it up a little bit. And another interesting note on Cruella de Vil is that in the Starlight Barking, the dogs decide they want to get revenge and they determine they're going to go and kill Cruella de Vil. But when they all, you know, go to do the deed, they see that she's moved on from fur and now she collects metallic plastic items. And they decide because of that, that they're going to give her a break and they don't murder her.
Metallic
items, which you have to just imagine in like the 1940s, 30s or 40s, when I think that was originally written, that maybe that was like a cool new futuristic thing, is like metallic looking plastics.
Like this,
but yeah, that was a specific thing.
I'm holding up my little action figure gun. I'm guessing that would be the metallic plastic. I don't know. Anyway, yeah, that's a very specific thing to collect.
It is very specific and it saved her life. So
I'm just wondering if Dottie Smith maybe was having a I don't know, like a opioid addiction by this point, prescription drug addiction.
So I mean, funny you should mention that. I don't think that it was necessarily drugs. It might have been Jesus, because she I guess her mom got cancer and she got really close with her mom. And in the end of her mom's life, they both converted to Christian Science. And then from that point on, I think she was a Christian Scientist for the rest of her life. And it kind of coincides with a few, like they move to Hollywood. There's one, right? The second part is that her husband files for a conscientious objector to get out of the war. So that explains that like anti-nuclear plot line in the second one. So that there's a few, and then the Christian Scientist thing, maybe that makes sense where all of a sudden everyone's got ESP and they can fly and they can just operate technology on command, because you know that newfangled technology that's too hard to operate in those stupid punch card and abacus machines, you know, it'll be great if you could just think your way right through it. So I don't know, a lot of those elements seem to be explained by some of those moves that she kind of made towards you know, after she wrote that original book and it blew up and she moves to Hollywood and adapts some new ideas and makes new friends.
Ah, religion is the opiate of the masses. Okay. Seems so. Yeah, I guess you change. You have a whiplash of you're going to get some weird, you know, weird wake in that whiplash. Does that make any sense? I don't know. I've never converted. So I don't get the revival spirit, I guess. But
and it would be weird too that if your husband's family were Titanic survivors. It's just, I don't know. It's an interesting time to grow up and an interesting set of people. And her parents were, you know, into Hollywood. So it wasn't like she just was this bumpkin that grew up in the middle of, you know, an English sort of shire and just wrote this book and was obscured. There's probably a good reason why the book we even know about and even got adopted is because, you know, she kind of grew up in like a very eccentric family and time period.
Right on. I did note that one other difference, the dog relationship is a whole lot more convoluted, where Pongo has the Dalmatians with like a different dog or something, but and then Parrot is like the stepmom or something, which seemed needlessly convoluted.
So in the book, and man, I'm not doing a dissertation, so I might have some of this wrong, but I think in the book, in addition to the original puppies that Pongo has, there's like a whole other group of Dalmatians that are just already kind of in storage that were going to be turned into coats as well. And that's where the 101 come from. They don't all come from the same dog. And I don't know if they almost imply it in the animated original movie, but he just says, you know, they're like 101, where'd these come from? And then the dad looks over at Pongo and he's like, Pongo, you old rascal, you know, kind of implying that he's the one that made all of the 100 puppies over the course of, you know, well, which I think is just kind of like maybe a tongue in cheek reference to the original book. But I think in the book, they kind of explicitly say that it's not all from Pongo.
Oh, they do in the movie that he just has 15, right? The others are at the mansion, I believe. But, you know, he could have been right, a bad dog.
But also in the animated movie, the owners are absolutely clueless because they still at the end of the movie don't even realize that Cruella de Vil was involved in kidnapping the dogs and was actually serious about turning them into a coat. They just kind of have like the husband has some suspicions and that's pretty much where it stops. Whereas in the remake movie, you know, they no uncertainty about what she's trying to do.
Karmatically, though, that it works because he made a bunch of money, you know, writing a parodying song with her. So, I mean, that is one thing. They're talking about how, oh, he's a down and out songwriter and all that sort of stuff, which he's something else in the book. I think in the movie he became a down out songwriter simply so they could put a few songs in the movie. Apparently that's what is referred to as an old theater trick. Just make them a songwriter. But I'm like, okay, they're supposed to be down and out and poor and they have a maid. What? Huh? I guess a different time.
Yeah. Come on. We're not talking poor. We just mean like, you know, normal poor.
Yeah. Old money poor.
Which means you still have like multiple cars and a nice mansion with like three stories and the resources to not only raise 100 Dalmatians, but then to say, let's buy an entire plantation just dedicated to it.
Well, he has made his Cruella song money by then, so by the end of the movie they are a
song.
Well,
yeah, I guess so, but and the ball's on this guy to write a song about his wife's friend that she already told him to lay off, and it turns into his biggest hit.
It keeps making me think of there's the on the Tim and Eric sketch comedy show a few years back, there is the petite feet song, which a guy walks in with, you know, tiny feet, and then they start doing a song. Each time you watch it, it seems cooler because they're like, oh, this guy just walks into the bar and they just mercilessly start making fun of him in song form, and he's kind of into it or whatever. It's a great clip. But yeah, it's like the insult song directed at a acquaintance in your presence is kind of weird, I guess.
It leaves open some interesting dynamics, though, because if there was like a spiritual successor to the animated movie, not only have they taken away this lady's, you know, main, like she was using all of her resources to do this, and now they're just taunting her and writing songs about her, and they've got every single dog back. Not a single dog succumbed to the cold or anything, you know. We've got 100 of them. So, I mean, it's almost like they're just begging her to come in and kidnap them again. And all it would take is just hire two goons that are just slightly more competent And I mean, she could at least take out a few of them. Like, not even a question. She could make a pair of shoes.
Yeah. I didn't realize that one of the goons was Weasley's dad, Ron Weasley's dad. I think the actor's name's Tom, but in the live action one, excuse me. Who is the main goon again? He's someone quite notable.
Hugh Laurie from
yes, House. Thank you. Yes, watching Dr.
House. And a bunch of other stuff, of course. Yeah.
No, for me, Hugh Laurie's always, like Blackadder is still my main thought of Hugh Laurie, okay. Which is like the last thing people think of now. But when I see him, I always think of Blackadder. So there's probably a few other people that do. That was a popular enough show. But yeah, I did like the casting. Jeff Daniels, sorry, I'm just skipping ahead to the live action one because I guess I watched it most recently. But yeah, this was coming. I think maybe that was another turnoff. One, I was the wrong age for that when it came out. And two, I'd just seen Jeff Daniels in like Dumber and Dumber, and I didn't want to see him like in a wholesome, quirky role. So,
well, so I mean, believe it or not, like I was also, because I think we're similar ages. So I was also not the demographic of the live action remake, at least. The original animation, same thing. Like it was a babysitter at some point, I'm sure. But rewatching the live action was actually a whole lot better than I was expecting it to be or that I remembered it being. And I kind of appreciated that they didn't do the stupid look who's talking now animal voices. You know, there was a few places where they might have done some kind of cheesy sound like VO, like, ooh, you know, like they're making like sort of like baby cooing noises. But other than that, I actually really appreciated the original aspect of just having a bunch of trained animals do tricks for a majority of the movie.
Yeah, and I had forgotten that it has a John Hughes script, which is pretty trippy. And you know, they paid him way too much money. There was like contractual problems. In the Disney War book, there's a whole bunch about this, but I think it's one of the things that got maybe it might have been one of the last thing Katzenberg did, which, you know, got Michael Eisner to really get pissed at him or something, paying John Hughes so much money to write this script or something. So if you read that book, you
it
know,
didn't ever, seem like they needed it. Like anyone could have written this script.
Yeah. 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 That was
aspect.
Exactly. So when last time I was like, John Hughes wrote the script, what that's so. And then I kind of remembered, but it's yeah. If you've read the Disney War, it's so convoluted. You can't remember what horrible thing, who did the what. So I guess that's just a, yeah. Corporate sniping, you know, it's a different world than hopefully most of us live in. Now, in the original, of course, we got Rod Taylor, who's in the Time Machine. He's in some Twilight Zones. This is just before he actually became a name. So he is kind of just a rando voice actor here, but quickly became a, the Birds. Okay, the Time Machine had already come out. He was in Inglourious Basterds. That's wild. Okay. Are you familiar with him, I mean, Rod Taylor?
No, I'd have to see a picture.
Okay. Have you seen the 1960 Time Machine?
Of course, but I mean, you know,
he's the guy sitting in the Time Machine.
Okay, the main actor from it.
Yeah, he's the star, and then he's in one of my favorite Twilight Zones. I might have mentioned to you, I do a Twilight Zone podcast where there's and When the Sky Was Open, where the astronauts come back from Earth and just start slowly like disappearing from reality, like everyone's forgotten they existed, and he's quite good in that. So but yeah, I was just kind of happy to see that he kind of got his start in this movie.
I mean, it seems that once people started getting into these movies, then either they would be rehired for, you know, every movie afterwards, or there was a handful that just kind of like went directly into obscurity, and it was like the only and last thing that they did.
Yeah, because now it's just like, you know, an animated Disney movie usually has to have like some all-star lineup, which is probably a bad idea most of the time. Of course, there's a few actors that can nail it on stage and end screen, but on stage, so, sorry, not voice acting in the new live action.
So we're on a little bit of a tangent, though, but the new Avatar movie just came out recently, and there's a very similar dynamic to that, too, where they're hiring big budget movie actors, but then just like painting them blue and then putting the stupid little motion tracking balls on their face and then having them emote and then do the VO. But it feels like such a missed opportunity to just have like random people that, you know, just are better at making facial expressions that you might not know who they are. It's just weird that like we still are expecting movie stars to play roles that we don't even see them in.
Yeah, I've heard several people after a movie be like, yeah, Kate Winslet was in it. What? Kate Winslet was in it? What? Where?
Why?
Why? It's a good question.
Yeah.
Now I found, just while we're on that movie, I did see it. And I feel like, will people like it? One is, did you like the, what did you think of the first Avatar? That's what you're going to think of the second Avatar. And okay, the other,
fair enough.
And the other I've seen that is both praise and criticism is, the second hour of the movie's just snorkeling. So
it's just live action snorks.
Yes. In 3D. So if that sounds fantastic, you'll love the movie. If you're like, no, that sounds way too long, it should have been shorter, then maybe it's not for you. Right. I love snorkeling. I was down for that. So, you know, I'm like, oh, the plot's not really going anywhere. We're just looking at like the space fish. That's cool.
To be honest, if a movie's longer than 90 minutes, I'm guaranteed to fall asleep. And the first Avatar, the first Lord of the Rings, like I saw all these on opening day in like a packed theater, and I fell asleep in every single one of them around the 50 minute mark or so. So yeah. Unfortunately, I feel like that would be the same destiny for me watching the new Avatar.
Yeah, I usually stick by that rule. Some 3D keeps me awake. I did fall asleep in The Hobbit, the animated Tintin, both after work too. So maybe I shouldn't have gone after work.
Yeah, the 3D maybe is worse for me, because now having to keep up the social appearance of your eyes being open is gone once that you have the you know, not only do you have the glasses on to hide that your eyes are closed, but everyone else is so engrossed in like the 3D aspect that it's only the snores that really give me away at that point.
Yeah. But the one, so I didn't shed too many tears over those two movies, but yeah, I went to see the new Bond film also after, well, it's not that new now, but you know, a year and a half ago. And I did take a notable nap in the middle of it and then had a podcast about it the next day. So oops. I was like, had to go back, read the week, and go, what the fuck happened to that movie? Not a bad movie. Not my favorite Bond by any means, by either. But
on that same note, now whenever I watch a movie, so when I started the original animated 101 Dalmatians and it pops up, I'm like, okay, yeah, and an hour and 19 minutes and give or take 10 minutes for the opening and ending credits. Like, that sounds very agreeable to me. And then when I started watching the 96 live action remake, I'm like, oh, an hour and 45 minutes. Like, all right, let's do it. Like they're just a little bit, takes the wind out of it for me. And that's definitely a change in how I used to feel. Cause I used to love like, oh yeah, a 3 hour movie. Why would you ever want to watch a 90 minute movie? It sounds like such a throwaway, but man, like, you know, give me a 60 minute movie. Give me a 50 minute.
No, I was watching Casino while going to sleep a few nights ago, and I think I got about 50 minutes in awake, and then woke up and it's like 1:30, and you know, something mad is happening on the screen. I'm like, whoa, what? The most fun is I have the 60s Batman on disc. So sometimes I'll put that on late at night, kind of fall asleep, and then wake up, and then the plot's kind of like in the same place, but now it's like a different villain.
It's the like same with the old Superman. The black and white Superman show is almost identical. You kind of fall asleep. You're like, oh, now they're in Africa, like turning coal into diamonds with his hands. And you fall asleep. Oh, now they're in Paris. Whatever. It's kind of like the same plot.
Well, no, a little different, because in Batman, they're always in Gotham City. And basically the same plot's happening. It's three episodes down the line that I slept through. So it's just a different villain. But the story actually seems to make sense, because it's got the same story for every two episodes. So that's kind of fun. I was kind of enjoying that. Taking a look, I guess I should go back to the animated one. I'm looking through my notes for things.
One of the cool things too is that instead of making the guy a musician again and writing songs, they make him of what they say is a video game designer, and what Disney says a video game designer is in 1996. But the things that he's doing are like not very video game designery. And he also lives in an interesting smart home. I guess you could call it a smart home, because he's got like a computer that says hello to the dog when the dog wakes up. And then there's like a little button that's rigged to the side of the door that's also connected to the computer. So they kind of make him seem like he's this technical whiz, but there's nothing else to back it up aside from that little opening sequence. And then just saying that he designs video games.
Well, I should note that the technology we're seeing in his game is pretty much what Disney was going to put up to the plate a year later when they opened Disney Quest. And that same technology you could go enjoy until about 2016.
Maybe. Although, I mean, I've been to Disney Quest many times because it was right, you know, right by where I was working for the longest time. But there was the Aladdin ride, which I think was ahead of its time. But the animation that they're showing in the movie as if it were the video game that they're playing, there was not a single device on the planet that could have played it at the resolution that they were talking about in or outside of Disney Quest until maybe very recently, like when Cuphead came out. So I guess the latest versions of maybe like PS4 or slightly earlier, where you could actually have that like cell animated look. But yeah, like the animated look. But it was also interesting because the crux of the game was just on how scary the bad guy was. Like, there was no gameplay aspect to it. The only feedback that their one video game expert person gave them was just that, you know, they needed to feel like they wanted to annihilate the bad guy. So he spends the entire movie trying to brainstorm the perfect villain for a video game as opposed to the perfect lyrics to some song. So they kind of tie in the same dynamic where the guy's using Cruella de Vil as the influence to like sell their big thing and hit it big. But this one made a little bit more sense, but also he seemed like just the worst video game designer. The game looked horrible. The graphics would have been interesting, but the game looked like it was
the garbage. Backgrounds all look like, yeah, I was about to say this game would have gone like head to head with Superman 64, you know, which
well, and it reminded me a lot of, I don't remember the show Nick Arcade, where they would put like the kids inside of the video games on like a green screen. But also right before they did that, they had these really cheap like shareware style platformer games that they would have them play head to head and just earn points. And there was a few that looked really similar to having this kind of like cell animated look to it. So yeah, it reminded me of Nick Arcade. Like if Nick Arcade actually had some kind of fidelity, it would have been this Dalmatian game that Jeff Bridges was working on that looked like it sucked.
It was kind of the backgrounds that were really making me think, because I, you know, the front, the cell stuff, I was like, oh, there's referencing the animated movie. That's cool. So I was kind of looking at the back and thinking, oh, that looks like digital garbage from the mid 90s. But yeah, the cell part for sure. Something interesting about the 1960 movie is, and this is definitely the first Disney movie that acknowledges television.
If you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/try.
Because the others are a little more fairy tale-ish. I don't think Lady and the Tramp is set in like 1908. So yeah, this is the first time
you're right.
Television mentioned, and we get
cool too, because they add like a little sepia tone and like a vintage effect even to the animation, even though it itself now is like a vintage animation. So it had a meta aspect to it for sure.
And that was my whole point. This is the first time with Disney really getting meta, because they have these fake commercials, which were quite enjoyable. And that's where they got one of the songs in the movie. And it's kind of just funny how they like some of the original reviews and the reviews. Again, it was more positive reviewed than I thought it was when it first came out. But some of the reviews are like, oh, it doesn't quite have enough music, because they were used to the older Disney movies, which would usually have one or two more songs, where this basically just has that jingle, the Cruella de Vil song. And
they try to sneak one in at the very end.
Right.
The Dalmatian Plantation.
Right.
Yeah.
Which was a fully composed song that simply didn't make it to the movie in its full form. I mean, I guess now
it wasn't as much of an earwig. The first one was more of an earwig, and just the melody was a great one for the Cruella de Vil song.
Yeah, it might have been a one-hit wonder. So as long as the royalties was, keep coming in. So, but yeah, you know, because I mean, movies have gotten so like, you know, meta now. Oh, that just happened. So I just thought it was interesting that this kind of seems to be the first time we get a little bit of meta creeping in, and not as in the Facebook thing, of course, as in the use of the word. It's hard to use that word now, that and quantum, right?
they're just gonna own every single word and like Latin sort of derivative. You won't even be able to put your own words together because they're gonna own all the roots.
We were watching the Bates Motel TV show, and I was like sitting there, when was Psycho the first time that term was used? And I went looking, I was like, wait a minute, it's a Greek word. Well, a little different. Actually, I did learn, you know, it's like Psycho with a K, I think. So maybe the Hitchcock movie's the first time we just started using it with the CHO spelling and calling that guy a psycho. So.
Well, I mean, how depends on how deep you want to get on that one, but that one was just because psychology and like the introspection kind of came from Jung and some of like the German and Austrian philosophers and psychiatrists. And then from them, the concept of psychology kind of came out with like Freud. Right. So a lot of it was kind of this Eastern European mentality. So a lot of it was spelt with the K in like almost like an Austrian, German, Swiss source. But as soon as it hopped over and came into America, then it kind of like dropped that and got the C. Anglicized.
Right. Because one of my one of the recent Twilight Zones I looked at, which I guess had an early 1961 air date, so they wouldn't have necessarily seen Psycho yet, that guy's psychological. And I was like, oh, it's kind of weird to say it that way. Like, that guy's crazy, that guy's psychological.
About the Psycho movie, that famous shower scene was actually based on an earlier movie from, I want to say it was like earlier than 42, might have been 38 or 39, but it was a movie called The Seventh Victim, and that actually had the OG shower scene that then got kind of, you know, ended up inspiring the shower scene from Psycho that became way more famous.
Right. Well, they got the editing snap, which I haven't seen the original. Maybe it's better. I don't know. But
no, I mean,
there might be a little more finessing on the newer one. But yeah, so just to segue it, I guess Cruella is pretty much a proper psycho. It's aimed towards dogs. But like you said, that in a way could be worse. Although I guess she's just making power moves, like you said, you know, old money power moves, because
yeah. I guess, although a lot of it doesn't make sense. So the only thing that explains all the plot gaps in any of the stories, you know, like the remake and the old one, and we're going to ignore the latest Cruella movie, but in the 96 remake and the original animation, it doesn't make sense that you'd have all these resources, especially if you had your own clothing company that was doing well enough that you could hire an entire staff and potentially an assistant that was somewhat competent, but then in your personal life, hire just the biggest bumbling idiots. And not just that, but why wouldn't you just buy one Dalmatian, a male and female Dalmatian, and just breed them yourselves? And you've got an endless supply of coats.
She doesn't want to live with the dogs.
Right. But she had the abandoned place that the guys went and took them to in both instances. Right. So like she clearly had the property to raise them on and had the two idiots to do the whole thing. So, I mean, there's that aspect. And then also the fact that she expects either in the live action version where she herself is going to go and somehow take all 100 puppies back and skin them personally, or in the animated movie where she expects her two henchmen to kill and skin all 100 of them overnight. Both of those are very unrealistic expectations of someone you'd probably expect to be a psychopath. Yeah.
When I was watching it, I did think of the Twilight Bark being like the early version of the Orange Alert, that we have now, you know, when a kid goes missing in the city or something, you have the orange alert.
Yeah.
So I was
yeah,
like,
Amber. Yeah, we get the Amber alerts. Yeah,
they should. Oh, maybe Amber. Sorry, it's been.
And,
a while
then, and it's Silver alert. If a grandpa wanders away from hospice, they'll call that a Silver alert.
Okay, I want to turn that to the Twilight bark, like in, you know, real life.
Honestly, dude, like just skip forward to the ESP and flying like that and just controlling technology with your mind.
Yeah, keep track of your kids using mind powers. Well, I guess some people have kind of done that. So,
but also, I mean, there's no other animal that's awake, right? So humans aren't around to hit you with cars. There's no other predators whatsoever. And again, you can fly at super fast speeds. You can communicate through ESP. So it almost seems like it would be the ultimate utopian paradise. So there's no danger whatsoever, I guess, right? Unless you just like overate yourself or you found like the chocolate factory and the dogs got into the chocolate. But otherwise, there's no natural predators around and you've just got your free reign of the entire planet. So I still want that movie to be made.
Oh, for sure. I don't know why they made 102 Dalmatians when they had that source material. So in either version, I think there's a live action one and an animated one. I mean, both made in around 2000. Yeah,
I couldn't find copies in time. I wanted to. And there was also a documentary made on the making of the animated film that I wasn't able to find a copy of. But after watching the 96 live action remake, and I feel horrible saying this because I'm an animation lover at heart, but I feel like out of the two, I'm more interested in the making of the real one than of the animated one, just because of how many different trained animals they needed. It just seems like that would have been such a cooler experience than just watching like 20 people scan things in Xerox machines for, you know, 3 years mm-hmm. on end.
Yeah. And all the, you know, you get all the design elements with the live action. So here you get a cool devil phone, but you know, someone drew that, right? You don't really need to see
the devil phone was a huge highlight. The Cruella de Vil design was a huge highlight. And I liked seeing someone draw. I don't know if you saw 100 on screen at one point, but, you know, there was a lot of drawing going on and I'm sure it was not fun and I'm glad I wasn't part of any of the production, but, it's interesting to see.
Maybe in the Death March, you get all 100 at some point
Fantasia might be a good exception to the rule here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was just thinking, didn't we see a shot of all the dogs coming into town? But I was like, no, that was Gremlins, which I watched for Christmas. This is the first film that I think, not the first, but yeah, Watt was really out by this point. He apparently was in on story meetings, but I assume he was probably starting to think about Epcot by this point and not thinking about the movie so much. Making that big map for Epcot, yeah.
And I don't know if this was just part of his business acumen and it was just something that he always did, but he also bought the rights to at least one of this lady's, Dodie Smith's, one of her other books. But they never actually produced it and it took the longest time. And I think finally in like 2016 or something, like UPN or no, sorry, it was like BBC ended up making a direct to video or like a TV based movie on one of her other books. But man, Disney just sat on that script for decades.
Yeah. I'm sitting here looking also, I guess Disney himself wasn't so satisfied with this film when it came out. Ken Anderson is the art director who really got the Xerox rolling. It says, as Watts said, we're never going to have one of those goddamn things again, referring to Dalmatians and its technique, and stated Ken's never going to be an art director again. So the man himself was not really into this, though apparently he basically apologized to the guy on his deathbed a few years later. So
what was he ever an art director again, or did those words actually damn him?
I should check that. He certainly had a few years that I guess he was a director and writer at Walt Disney Animation. Okay, he did the Jungle Book. They let him back in. Jungle Book's after Walt dies though, right? So it would have been in progress before that. For sure, though.
That sounds like such a Walt thing, though. Like that going in and publicly declaring, like, yeah, I hated the art director. I'm never going to hire him again. That's like just a classic Walt Disney type of move.
Oh, no. He's straight in on Sword in the Stone. or though maybe he was already doing that, because then it's Jungle Book's just story, it seems. Yeah, actually, he's not listed as a full art director again until 1977's Pete's Dragon, excepting Sword of the Stone, which was probably already in production. So, yeah, he's just a story guy between. So I guess there was some truth to those words. I don't know.
that Disney kiss of death.
Yeah, really. Because this is the one that's notorious for having so many Xeroxed Dalmatians, of course. And when we see they kept using the technology, but I guess not to this degree. I'm trying to think of another time pre-CGI where we would have seen like just extensive Xeroxing. I don't think the Rescuers or Robin Hood, I'm sure they have the Xeroxing, but maybe not so obvious.
Again, I mean, this one, with the context of watching it and knowing that this was the first time that they were experimenting with this new technique, and having seen all of the previous older ones right before we watched this one, it really still feels like amazing, especially for the time. But I guess I like seeing like the rough edges sometimes. It definitely lacks a little bit of polish in some of the animation sequences. But also, and this might be like the horrible thing for movie purists, but for some of these in the scenes, I'll watch it at like 1.5x or one, you know, as much as I can handle still listening and having the intelligible sort of dialogue. But once you start playing at those faster animation speeds, man, the older animation looks great because it's running at like 30 frames a second instead of 12 frames a second or 15.
Oh, I should have done that, because I actually did watch the newer one at slightly faster speed just because of time. I do that sometimes, but I watched
it's weird in live animated action. One. Live action gives it that weird soap opera look, but if you do it for animation, it just makes it look so much sharper.
Okay, I completely did it the wrong way then.
Yeah.
I watch animation at normal speed and the live action one slightly faster, but again, I'm used to that. Like 2 years ago, you know, I'd see my parent-in-laws downstairs watching like Korean dramas at double speed. I'm like, why are you doing that? You're not even enjoying the thing properly. But once I started doing a lot of podcasts, sometimes, especially when it's like an educational film or something, it's like double speed. So I guess I get it.
It's so much easier to speed something up than it would ever be to slow it down. Because if someone's talking really fast, even if you slow it down, it's a little bit harder to understand. But if someone just talks really slow, it just makes it so easy to speed it up, and you can get used to it within minutes.
What I love is on my phone, you know, listening to podcasts, sometimes I'll start the podcast and I've accidentally like hit the half speed or something, so suddenly everyone sounds tetched. You know, it's like what's wrong with them? Oh, it's my phone that's wrong with them. Okay, that's good. They didn't just get like a severe trauma blow to the head or something. I was thinking one reason maybe this doesn't seem like, because it kind of is one of the big Disney movies, but someone like me who doesn't watch it regularly might feel that way, because it doesn't, I don't think it's ever had the theme park presence, has it? You know, Peter Pan's got the rides, got the characters in the park, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I do know that Disney World in Orlando, they have their own little like fire department. It's very Dalmatian heavy themed, although I don't know if they draw direct examples between 101 Dalmatians.
I'm just sitting here trying to think of like, what would I make a 101 Dalmatians theme park attraction? Yeah, like this and Lady and the Tramp would be real difficult to make an attraction for those sorts of things.
No, the big one is you just sell a bunch of stuffed Luckies and stuffed Rollies. That's where the money's at anyways.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I don't know. Could you have like a car chase or a... it's not again, really exciting.
It's weird
enough.
Because the whole premise is that if you don't get away, they're going to kill and skin your dog. So maybe it's just hard to work like a ride around. Like that lady back there is literally skinning our dog.
Maybe you're going through the abandoned house, but there's like, it's like a little bit of a haunted house quality where it's like knives coming down, like you are the dog, right? And the knives are coming through, like, so you're in danger of getting skinned. You know, children under 8 would be very traumatized. Yeah. It could be the scariest ride at Disney. Cruella de Vil's just peering down at you, so we're like the alien.
I mean, and again, ride. Man, not, I mean, just to keep this nice and light, since that's where we're at already. but you just change the species of animal and it's literally just like an actual slaughterhouse where they make shoes and coats. You know, you just change it from a dog into a cow and then bam, like now it's real. Like it's no longer a movie plot. It's just someone went to work that day.
Well, they almost did that in Disney's America where they're going to have a roller coaster go through like a steel mill. Not so much death and gore there. Or how about this? So we can keep it a little Disney. So in the ride, like you're a person. You're not like a Dalmatian. It's not like what was it where you didn't see the character? Snow, the original version of Snow White. You never see Snow White because you're supposed to be Snow White. So like you're supposed to be the perspective of Snow White on the original ride. So they had to change it because everyone was just confused. You're like, where's Snow White? She's on the ride. No, you are Snow White. So in the Dalmatians ride, you would be the humans and there are Dalmatians trying to skin you. So you really understand their pain now or their trauma.
It would come off better than the Snow White ride for sure. Cause I also was very confused by that as a kid.
There's a few that seem to be like the kind of the MO, an original, like around the time 101 Dalmatians came out, it was kind of like, oh, you are the main character in the ride going through these experiences. So I don't know if I think by Pinocchio, they'd figured out not to do that anymore. But yeah, it is kind of weird. Like, yeah, because everyone's just like, where's the character then? I'm confused.
I mean, but also your only other option was to like stay at home and listen to the radio. So
yeah dark rides more exciting than that, I guess. The different number of accents in this one was kind of boggling. I mean, it makes sense from like it's a kid's movie. Well, I don't know, Disney movies, I guess is a family movie, it's for everybody. But yeah we have like the Dalmatians themselves, some of them sound kind of Britishish and some of them sound kind of American, and you're like, how did that happen?
And he's aside from father. Hugh Laurie being in it, and then aside from like one or two shots where they show Big Ben and some of like the city skyline, it really feels like it's happening in America. I mean, that's as an American watching it in America, it feels like it's happening there, but it didn't feel like it had any kind of like unique location aspect to it for sure. It happened anywhere you feel like it happened.
Yeah, because I guess Jeff Daniels is supposed to be an expat or whatever. I'm sitting here thinking of what is Jolie Richardson's actual nationality? Because I remember from Nip Tuck where she was definitely doing an American voice. So,
well, and Glenn Close is playing an American too.
Oh, yeah. Good. Oh, yeah. Weird stuff there. Okay. Let's see where Jolie's from. There she is. Okay. She hails from. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, she is born London, England. Okay, so she's doing the proper accent and was faking it.
That's canon.
Faking it in other movies I've seen.
So as much as I also wanted to credit just like the cool, I guess they're not practical effects, but like the trained animal scenes, I love that because it made it a little bit unique. And I'm kind of glad it didn't have the voices, even though I kind of liked Milo and Otis and I liked Homeward Bound with the voices, but I like just seeing animals do the tricks. I guess I'm really simple in that way. And on that same simple note, there's a point in the live action remake where one of the dogs like pees on a magazine and then they slip in the pee. And I don't know, that delighted me. I liked it. And I felt a little embarrassed for liking it so much because then immediately after, one of the goons, I guess, is checking to see if something's wrong with the car. And they imply that the way he checked to see if the car was okay by sticking his head right up to the tailpipe and it like blew it over. And I just made a note that, you know, some of the jokes here are just childish. And then I looked at my note above that was like, I like it when they slip in the pee. So
oh, I guess. Yeah. I remember I have a few fully stupid notes here. I wrote, I want to steal puddles. That's not, that was fun. Just, I guess it was the pronunciation of the movie. Let's see. I was assuming Master had ganja in his pipe because he's a musician. Yeah. Where else?
There's something too that I like about seeing classic cartoons where the characters smoke or drink, just because it happens so much less now. You know, the I don't know. It feels like it's dating it in like a cool way. Like they make smoking cool again because it's in this old animated movie.
Of course, now we have like, you know, they'll have stills where, of course, you just airbrush or CGI out the cigarettes in people's hands. So I think even some of the Get Back promo materials for the Beatles one, I think in the pictures, maybe they got rid of it. Of course, in the movie, they didn't because that's just not realistic or whatever. So
the movie came with a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, it was weed. You should have. Yeah, it was second for sure. Sorry, I had a thought about, I lost that thought, but I will go really back to Jolie Richardson. I also noticed when I was on her page that she is Vanessa Redgrave's daughter, which I did not know. So it's kind of interesting. Dirty Dogs, all that stuff. I'm having a look on my notes. I might be through my basic thoughts. This isn't one that has like, you know, it's got movie magic, but I guess it doesn't have too much magic unless you want to like give me something I totally missed.
Well, there's a little bit of magic in that. I mean, let's ignore the 101 Dalmatian part. Let's just go on the first 15 in the first litter, and that these puppies all make this like huge trek through the snow, and they're, you know, living among soot and being cared after by criminals. But even in that first litter delivery, it seems very statistically unlikely that every one of the 15 would make it through. Not just birth, but then everything else that happens to them. I mean, if it was just a little bit more realistic, it just becomes a very sad movie immediately, because now you're talking about at least a handful of dead puppies within, you know, a couple months time lapsed. And so I consider that movie magic.
What was up with the maid anyway? She's like, here, let me show you your dead puppy first.
Well, and in the cartoon, it almost feels like she was throwing him like a softball, like, oh, you know, Masters, that hasn't been feeling great. There's this puppy that's probably dead, but he could probably, you know, if I just like bump it, it'll come back to life, but I'll let him do this. Because she almost gives it to him and like smiles about it and like skirts off. And then in the movie, and again, maybe it's just because Disney doesn't want like that somber, like, here's a dead puppy I'm handing you. But even in the movie, she kind of just like hands it off to him very matter-of-factly and just kind of like walks away. So it feels very low risk in both scenario. But I can't imagine any other outcome where like, what is it, like the first 10 minutes or 15 minutes opening and there's already a dog, like a puppy that they kill on screen. There's just no way that works in a Disney movie.
No, I mean, they can't really be like, well, 98 puppies made it in the end because they went through a death march on the snow. And that's pretty, yeah. That's pretty good odds.
But Rolly didn't make it.
I mean, you know, I guess it's not that long of a death march, but still, yeah, little puppies, they're not all making it. Sorry. You know, if you get like 70% back, you're doing pretty good. And 84 new puppies is not a good Christmas present, which I think we've already alluded to a bit anyway. But
yeah, I mean, that's logistically, that sounds like that is now your life. Like you're now the Dalmatian people for the rest of your life.
Well, they are getting a plantation, so I guess they're owning it. I just have this one little note that I when Scotland Yard fails, you need the animal farm. So
yeah, and it's interesting that Scotland Yard would give a shit about the, or, you know, would care at all about these people's kind of mutts, right? Like, oh, so great. You've got this unneutered dog and an unfixed female, and they're just making hundreds of puppies. Yeah, like we're gonna look into that. We're gonna look into the people that are stopping you from doing that.
We're gonna prioritize that. We got five people on it right now, man.
People go to jail for that all the time here in the States for hoarding animals. I mean, technically it's animal abuse, and I don't see how two people could ever take care of 100 different puppies without one of them getting stuck behind the couch and, you know, stinking the place up after a month.
Oh, here's an interesting thing in Japan. I don't know if it's the same in the States, but I think they passed a law 2 years ago where basically all pets are now chipped. So you'd be able to find the Dalmatians real fast, but it's just kind of creepy.
I don't know if it's actually a law, but if it's definitely looked down on if you don't have it chipped. But yeah, there's definitely Like, you wouldn't be required to have your animal chipped.
Okay. Yeah. I think they've gotten to the requirement phase here, which has kind of a funky smell about it. I think we just have too
many here.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I don't know. In Japan, it's like, hey, let's start chipping the people. Yeah, Japan would probably just be like, yeah, sure, whatever, which, you know.
I mean, on that topic, though, I don't think that you need chips. I mean, who doesn't have a phone?
Yeah, so, we carry them around with us.
Yeah.
The pets don't do that. So, because every once in a while, I think I'll keep my phone off for a while. And I'm like, I need to send a message. So, yeah, we're all talking about opioid addictions, the opioid of the phones. So,
I mean, they're smart, you know, put your chip right next to your crack, right? Your little crack pipe that you keep in your pocket all day.
All right. Yeah. 2-for-1 special. Are there any big points, other points you want to throw out on this particular flick?
No, again, they're both interesting watches. I would much prefer to have seen either of these over Lady and the Tramp, any version. And I appreciate not having lots of music. And I realize that probably puts me in a certain niche of Disney movie watchers. But I liked it. I liked the animation. I liked the reuse and the sloppy looks and even the freaking live action remake. Although the one thing that the live action remake could have absolutely done without was this stupid scene where the dogs are like riding down a little tunnel and they've got that classic 1996 CGI that just takes you completely out of it, and it just makes absolutely no sense that they spent all that money on, you know, actual dog trainers and had actual dogs and throughout the entire movie except for a cumulative 20 seconds of horrible CGI. So it just stood out so glaringly, and I just wonder if maybe they could just like retouch that up or just cut it out of future versions, or if it's just canon now. That's just part of it.
It's canon. It's part of the dogs verse now. So
it's the worst. It's easily the worst part of the whole movie by far.
And they were thinking about having the puppies singing a song as they leave Hell Hall, and that got clipped. I think
that would have been even worse.
Yeah. So they did you a solid there, because I guess the music's pretty much baked into this movie, and like we said, there's not that much of it. You know, it's in the commercial. He's actively writing the songs, so that's how they enter the movie. That seems reasonable enough.
And also, I want to think, in 1996, I don't know if Disney had put out a single good video game at this point either. So the fact that they have a video game designer in their movie, It seems like anything that might have came out of this in terms of video game ancillary products would have been an absolute nightmare for the next decade.
Two decades. That's why we're out Disney Quest.
Yeah, that's right.
And I went to Disney Quest, I think it was 2009 or 2010. But our express purpose of going there was because they had all the retro games. They had like, what, two floors of like real old school game. So we weren't really there for the VR experience. Cause if we had gone there for that, we would have been like horribly disappointed. We did some of that stuff cause it was there. I think Aladdin gave me a headache or made me nauseous or something, but, So we did some of that stuff. We did the bumper cars. That was fun. But our main goal for being there was all the retro gaming, which was very cool. And there was some, I'd have to ask my boy. There was some game where it's like that was like the only place that existed at that point in time. So we were on a very geeky. We had a satisfying journey to Disney Quest, which I haven't heard too many people say.
one of the games that they had there too, I think, ended up going to Vegas somewhere. But it was one of the first. They called it virtual reality, but really you just put like a little goggles in front and it had, you know, a screen close to your eyes. But it was a multiplayer arcade game that four different people all played a different role, and I think you were trying to like either avoid getting assassinated by this big robot, or you had to work together to kill this big robot. And it was straight out of the 90s, you know, like it had like Lawnmower Man style 3D graphics, but it was legitimately like a really interesting thing that you wouldn't see anywhere else.
Yeah, so we can thank Jeff Daniels for designing all of that.
Thank you, Jeff Daniels.
Well, close it up for today. So this should be, I guess, mid-February-ish. Anything going on with you about that time?
We've got a whole bunch of new comics in the works, and hopefully we'll be about halfway done with a new Paranoid pamphlet. My original one you can see at mkultracomic.com, and that's a little pamphlet in the style of Chick Tracks, and it explains the whole backstory of the CIA's top secret MK Ultra program. And the next pamphlet that we're working on now is the whole backstory and history of homunculi, which is the plural form of a homunculus. And it explains where they come from, who originally wrote about them. And it even includes some recipes from ancient grimoires on how to make your own.
So and more about dogs. I'm
pretty excited. Yeah.
That's fun. So I was going to ask you, what is your favorite Chick Track?
I have to go with a classic. There's one called The Beast, and the cover just has like an all-American family, nuclear family, husband, wife, brother, sister, but they all have like upside down crosses on their heads. And it just talks about just various Satan. Everything is Satan. And then there's another really good one that's about trick or treating, and I think it's called Trick or Treat, and it just talks about like the pagan origins of Halloween. We can go off on a long list of some of my absolute. There's a fairly newer one called Virtual Reality, which explains that the escapism of virtual reality headsets represent sort of like a satanic departure from God in the world. So obviously they always have that very hardcore fundamentalist Christian vibe to them. So like, no matter what you're doing, if it's not praying, then Satan's got a hold of you and you have to repent. So that's kind of the ongoing theme.
My favorite, I think it might just be Angels or the Blue Angels or something like that, but it's the one with the rock band that signs up with Lucifer. I picked that one up faster and Cruel DeVille.
They have to really smack you over the head with it, don't they?
And when they're on stage, it shows them singing their song, which is like, we're going to rock with the rock is the lyric to their song. But the best is one of them goes into a gay marriage and the manager is like, I'll give you a wedding present, some AIDS. So then the guy like dies of AIDS or whatever. So
man, if you look into the band Chick Track, like there's some Chick Tracks that even Jack T. Chick died a while ago. And now it's in like the hands of like the third or fourth person that's been running it now. But there's some books that even the Chick Publications company doesn't even acknowledge anymore that exists.
It's my favorite's one of those. Yes.
Yeah. I don't want to repeat what some of the topics are, but some of them are absolutely beyond dark. And because if you think about it, a lot of his audience were, people that were, fundamentalist Christians, but also prisons. So he appealed a lot to some of like the worst things you could imagine someone may be in prison for. And there was a pamphlet that would pretty much line up with whatever vice you might have found yourself having. And then a pamphlet telling you that, Jesus forgives you for it. Just, go to church next time and buy a bunch of these pamphlets and give them to all your friends.
I'm just happy I was introduced to them properly, being handed one or more on the University of Georgia's campus. So
how old were you at that point?
Like 18, 19. I mean, it's already hysterical. Okay. No, that vintage we just had, this would have been like 98, 99, and we had a whole lot of fundamentalists just like doing stump speeches around the university and stuff. I have a feeling that maybe that still happened. It's the Deep South. I don't know.
Well, I found my first one in 2001 on a payphone on a military base. And I had no idea what I was looking at. It didn't seem funny. It seemed interesting. Mine was, I think it was called Bad Bob or Big Bad Bob. And it was about this biker that had all these tattoos and he went to jail for like killing somebody, but he finds God in jail. When he comes back out, he doesn't want to hang out with his old biker friends anymore. And they like make fun of him and stuff. But it was basically about this guy, Bad Bob. And when I found out, I was like, man, this is kind of like a cool thing that I hadn't seen before. And it took me years until I started seeing other ones. And I realized, there's a very specific theme here. But this is such an interesting little niche topic, but it's a comic book. By all definition, it is absolutely a comic book. But because it's fundamentalist Christian, it doesn't get the same credentials as if it were about, you know, like a counterculture or like a snarky thing. People would call it a comic book, but if you define it as a comic book, it is the most prolific comic series that humanity has ever seen, the both in volume of print, but also just the amount of storylines that were self-written and produced and created by one person, and the number of languages that any comic book has been put out on the face of the planet. So like, it would just break so many rules within the comic industry that at this point they can never acknowledge Chick Trax as being actual comic books, because he would just start taking all these awards that just doesn't mesh. Like, the fundamentalist Christian crowd and the current sort of hardcore comic nerd crowd does not have a very tight Venn diagram.
I haven't seen this one. I hope there's a Chick Trax showing you about the evils of comic books or something.
Oh, I think that would be too self-aware. I think that one might be a little bit over the line, but man, that's an interesting one. I mean, because Jack Chick loved comics and loved drawing. I mean, you know, that was his entire life. So I don't think they would be that much of a self-incriminating thing, but you know, it would be an interesting one to find.
He can sacrifice who he loves most in the name of Jesus, this kind.
and I don't know if you know this, he actually had a series of legit color comic, like the regular sized comics and panels. They just were so much more expensive to produce and ship and resell that they never really took off. They were called Crusader Comics.
I was like aware of those, and I never read one, because that's not what I want from this.
But to me, they were just beyond fascinating. And I found him when I was in my 20s, knowing who Jack Chick was at that point. So I knew what I was going to be in store for. But I actually have a really good friend that grew up with these Chick Trax being given to him at church. And then his parents would go to like the Christian bookstore and buy him Crusader Comics at like age 8 or 9 and give it to him, be like, read this. This is important. And also, it's a really cool comic book. So like it didn't go in with that kind of like, oh, what a funny, you know, silly thing. I'm a 20-year-old and, you know, I'm going to go and drink a beer and laugh about this. But imagine coming across Chick Trax and Crusader Comics at like age 8, 9, 10. And that's the media that you're consuming. It's such a different sort of mentality.
Just one more tangent on that tangent. Did you ever make it to the Holy Land experience in Orlando?
I didn't. I drove by it thousands of times, you know, because I had to drive by it on my way to Disney at least twice a day. And then every job that I had until very recently also brought me right by that. And I missed that I didn't, but I saw a Bill Maher documentary that wasn't a very good documentary, but he goes to the Holy Land experience. And I feel like I vicariously saw enough of it through his documentary that I never actually had to pay money to go inside. A fun fact is that in order for the Holy Land experience to get some sort of a tax break and maintain that they were like a religious church oriented thing, they had to make 1 or 2 days out of the year, like a free, anyone can come and, you know, entrance is open for the public type of thing. And when they did that, it absolutely decimated that entire area. Like, you couldn't park anywhere because all the parking lots and all the businesses around the Holy Land experience were taken up by people that wanted to go in for free that day. And it was just kind of like an unknown thing that, you know, you weren't getting anything done on that side of town if it was one of those free days that they only had for a stupid tax break reason.
Yeah, I guess it's the sort of thing where you don't want to go there till you can't, you know, while it's there, it's like, oh, God, no. But yeah. Once it's gone, you're like, oh, I should have had that little kitsch experience.
For the last, I want to say, like right before COVID hit, but for like a year up until then, they were auctioning off all the stuff. Like, so you could have walked away with like some cool Holy Land experience, sort of like marquees and props, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Decorate the house. Okay. I think we've gotten way away from Dalmatians, but hey, the theme park's adjacent to all this, right?
Well, we started out with Christian Science and ESP and honestly a God coming down from the sky and asking dogs if they wanted to go back up with him. And honestly, it might be good that we didn't get to go into my Heaven's Gate rant, which it just reminded me of that nonstop of the Hale-Bopp comet and this serious dog star. And like, there's an oncoming nuclear war, but you can follow me, but you'll cease to exist, but you'll live in the stars forever. I don't know. I still want to see that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The Starlight Barking.
Barking. Highly recommend. Even if you don't want to read the whole book, just read the synopsis in case this sounds like I'm just making it up. All of that, 100% true. ESP, flying technology, nuclear war, serious dog star god, all of it.
I want to see Robert Zemeckis make that as one of his Uncanny Valley CGI films. That would be fantastic.
What? And in a fun note to just put a cherry on top of that, in the Starlight Barking book, the Sirius, the Lord Dog Star, actually appears on top of Nelson's column, and that's like kind of like an important monument that I think dates back to very old times, like 20 BC or something, like the very original version, all the way to where in World War II, Germany wanted to take it because it meant all this importance to them. And that's where Sirius, the Dog Star, appears, is on top of this column. And that exact same column in 2015, Disney paid, I think, like $30,000 to turn it into a huge giant lightsaber to promote Star Wars. So I feel like Dodie Smith would have appreciated that, because she would have been like, oh, there's my Lord Dog Star appearing on the column.
Ruff, ruff.
Yeah. But also means a nuclear war was soon to follow. So
if you're a facilities manager at a warehouse and your HVAC system goes down, it can turn up the heat, literally. But don't sweat it. Grainger has you covered. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products for all your operations, including warehouse HVAC maintenance. And even better, they offer access to experts and fast delivery, so you and your warehouse can both keep your cool. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.